Brahms was very much invested in studying Luther's Bible. He was brought up as a Lutheran. He maybe had become more free-thinking in later years under the influence of Schumann and Joachim, but he was wanting to create a requiem which wasn't necessarily about the apocalypse, it wasn't necessarily about being redeemed, it was about finding comfort, which he could do through the German text and through sort of reflecting the personal connections he'd made.
Julian Johnson, was that a radical move in the context of other requiems that had preceded it and the requiems that Brahms himself would have known, musically and possibly even theologically speaking?
Well, of course, as Laura said, he's avoided the Catholic liturgy and there's absolutely no Latin here, and he reacted against any suggestion that when the text was translated that Latin might have been one of the languages. So in that sense, yes, but it's also a German requiem because he's drawing on a tradition of German music, which goes back a long way. And certainly one of the pieces that we know that he was drawing on and referring to was a piece that predates his beloved Bach and goes back to Heinrich Schütz, a piece that goes back to the early 17th century, which sets similar text, which also subtitled itself a German requiem. So it's also Brahms placing himself in this much longer tradition of German music.
Do you both think he was an agnostic? Do you think that's a reflection of his faith? The fact that not only is it we're not dealing here with the Catholic liturgy, we also have a requiem in which the name Jesus or Jesus Christ is not mentioned once. And in fact, Rheinthaler, who was preparing the premiere performance in Bremen Cathedral in 1868, wrote to Brahms and said, look, you really might think about doing something about this, because you know what, you perhaps ought to mention our Saviour. But Brahms absolutely didn't want to, and he wrote a little revealing little letter where he says in a few lines why it was very important that actually not only could this not, might it be, why it's a German requiem, but he said he might equally have called it a human requiem. And then he says, but I've already said too much. So I just wonder, both of you, whether you think part of this is, where Brahms stands in relation to faith and the institutions of faith that he was familiar with as a Protestant at the time.
It seems that he was a believer. He wasn't necessarily somebody who subscribed to a particular branch of religion. And I think actually the kind of Protestantism that he belonged to was much more about critical inquiry and questioning belief. So that was still something that was very much within ideas of Protestantism within Germany in the mid-19th century. He was very much in keeping with his contemporaries in that regard.
On one hand, then, he's writing a personal piece, but actually the tribute here is to musical history, maybe even more than it's about faith, perhaps.
Well, I think it's both, and perhaps Brahms didn't actually divide those two things. I mean, he is setting religious texts, extracts from the Lutheran Bible that he selected himself, obviously very carefully. And as you say, Tom, I mean, he kind of cuts out any overt reference to the Redeemer, to Jesus. So much so that, yeah, at that first performance, Joachim and his wife Amelie had to play some extra bits of music, including bits of Handel's Messiah, Erbarme Dich from the Bach St. Matthew Passion, to try and add in those bits that Brahms had missed out. But over and over again, both in this piece and in other works of Brahms, when he sets religious texts, you have a very strong statement of, well, to put it really bluntly, life is dark and life is hard and full of suffering, but, and it's over and over again in these texts, in every single movement, I think, there's an aber halfway through, the word of the Lord, liveth forever, basically. That's effectively what he says. So whatever the nature of his faith was, he does seem to want to restate that in his own way. Yeah.
Laura, one of the things that's going on in this piece, when Brahms writes it, he's after all in his early 30s. I mean, Brahms is one of those composers for whom, as soon as you hear the phonemes that make up the composer's name, you imagine a beard, at least I do, a big grey beard and a rather curmudgeonly guy sitting in his, you know, Viennese, actually pretty well squalor, but anyway, but the Viennese sort of bedsit that he lived in for most of his life. Anyway, when Brahms writes this piece, he's absolutely not that person, is he, Laura?
No, he's 35. He is making his name as a composer. This is the Brahms pre-symphonies. He's written some of the famous chamber works in the 1860s, but this isn't the kind of Brahms, the symphonist, Brahms, the late composer that we often think of him as being. So this is very much a man trying to deal with ideas of death within life, sense of trying to find comfort and consolation from the Requiem, rather than sort of looking forward to his own death, which I think is what we always assume is happening with his Requiem in particular.
What about his relationship with Schumann, both Robert and Clara, and where that fits in the piece, if there's any relationship with it? Partly thinking that Schumann's vision for what a new German music, I mean, after all, he'd already called Brahms the eagle who was going to save German music. One of Schumann's visions for what German music should do was write big choral pieces. I mean, is this piece, I wonder, a kind of Brahms responding to, you know, Schumann, who'd already died, of course, but responding to that request for a grand choral piece that would somehow, I don't know, redeem German music in some way?
Well, that's possible. Clara certainly recognised this piece as fulfilling Schumann's predictions that Brahms would emerge from writing these piano pieces, which Schumann described as veiled symphonies, to write for choir and orchestra, and that he hoped that he would excel in that field and be the kind of leading light of German music in that way. Maybe Brahms did have that in mind, but actually Schumann saying Brahms is going to be the saviour of German music wasn't an easy task to deal with, in the sense that he's
like, okay,
he's then got to do it. And you can see actually kind of Brahms in the late 1850s, early 1860s trying to get to grips with actually how he sat within the German musical scene and how he could in some ways fulfil or maybe divert attention from what Schumann had expected of him.
I mean, the point is, Julian, that this, however much it's writing out Brahms' own feelings about his mother or relationships with Schumann or anything else, this is a big public piece, inevitably. A big choir, big orchestra.
Yes, and I think Laura's right. He did, as it were, step up to that role of wanting to address society more broadly, just as Schumann had, after writing lots of songs and small piano pieces, feel the need to step up and write big symphonic works. I think this is Brahms daring to do that and daring to try that out. There is, and I think it is important, there is a potential relationship back to the Schumanns, which is much closer, which kind of bears out, as it were, the thrust of your question, which is that the first part of this that Brahms seems to have written, which is what we know as the second movement, the kind of funereal march of, you know, all flesh is as grass, which seems to have come out, at least he hinted as much to one of his friends, the kind of music that he was trying to write amid all that turmoil after Schumann's attempted suicide and his illness, when he was living in the Schumann house. That music that got turned eventually into the first movement of the D minor piano concerto. So there is another sense, I mean, I don't doubt that this is in relation to Brahms's mother and the death of Brahms's mother, but there is another sense in which it does also relate to the death of Schumann and also this idea of comfort, you know, solace, comfort for Clara, I think.
Yeah, there's that, but there's also a kind of practical aspect to this as well, which is that by the 1860s, Brahms is directing a lot of choral music in Vienna and so forth. So he's writing for choruses in part because he's directing and conducting. And so there's a kind of practical impetus for it as well, to provide for the repertoire.
Mm. Now, Julian, you mentioned that the second movement, then Alles Fleisch ist ist wie Gras, so all flesh is as grass. Now, I'm going to play you a couple of bits of music now, just to get your ears in gear for the performance of Marin Alsop and the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. Have a listen to this. This isn't by Brahms, but it you may hear a relationship between this music and the second movement of Brahms's Requiem. Have a listen.
Thank you.
Okay, keep that in your ears, and now let's listen to Brahms's the second movement of the German Requiem. Okay, so it's the same tune, yeah? the first piece is Bach's Cantata number 27, and Bach is in fact using a chorale, which is a Lutheran chorale, sort of part of the repertoire by a composer called Goldmark. So this is in fact not even Bach's tune. So Julian Johnson and Laura Tunbridge makes the point that what Brahms is doing in this piece is relating to, very consciously and very heavily, a German Lutheran tradition of music, simply.
Well, as Laura said, Brahms was busy conducting the Vienna Singakademie in this kind of repertoire, in Bach cantatas. He became a friend of Philipp Spitter, the great Bach biographer, great Bach scholar. And that sense of drawing on that musical tradition into his own music, absolutely essential. But actually, even the words of that chorale that he's setting are close to the Requiem. In short, if you summarise the words of the chorale text, it's essentially, life is dark, life is full of suffering, but what's the point in that? look on the bright side, effectively. Look ahead, look to the Lord, is effectively what the chorale text says. And that's what's played out in each of the movements of this piece.
Where else, Laura, in the German Requiem, do we hear Brahms, in a way, paying homage and taking on the traditions of German music? I mean, there are a lot of fugues in the German Requiem.
There are certainly a lot of fugues. There are breakthroughs into major keys at the end of movements, which might be a sort of Beethovenian homage. But you also, yes, you have all of the old-style singing. You have the a cappella choruses and so forth, within a very modern idiom. And I think that Brahms, yes, he acknowledges that there are chorale-like tunes, and there certainly are, and they might have their roots in a much longer tradition, but they needn't necessarily have. He's making them very much his own. And there were critics such as Schubring who recognized this as a very modern composition, and those older styles are sort of sat within a much more chromatic and imaginative orchestral writing. So there's a tension between what the orchestra's doing, what the harmony's doing, and what the choir and soloists are doing.
Okay, look, where then do you hear the modernity in the German Requiem?
Listen to the harmonies. Basically, if you think about how the orchestra begins this work and it sort of sets up all of these different dissonances.
You mean right at the start? You mean
right at the start?
There's no violins in that movement.
There's no violins. We have very deep timbres. Mm-hmm. We have the pedal. We have the seventh coming in as the next note. And then we have these lovely kind of squeezing chromaticisms before the choir comes in, and suddenly things become much more consonant. And so we have the voices being the old style and the orchestra being somehow new. Mm.
And it's absolutely, I think, that tension between the two which goes to the heart of this piece. And it is that tension between something that feels very ancient, a grand tradition, as it were, and this very modern doubt, those little chromatic twists. And not to forget, of course, that revisiting the old was exactly where the modern was in the 1860s. So that at exactly the same time as Brahms is writing the Requiem, you have Bruckner discovering what the Sicilian movement made famous in terms of the sort of stripped-back modality of choral music. And just a few months after the premiere of the German Requiem, Wagner's Die Meistersinger, composers we're not supposed to put in the same box, and yet they're doing something very similar. If you listen to the first act of Meistersinger after the end of the overture, what you get is a beautiful German chorale with instrumental commentaries. That's exactly what you get in the first movement of the Requiem.
The third movement is that one of those really doubting movements of the German Requiem, that with the baritone solo, and it ends with, as Laura was saying, one of those breakthrough fugues.
The bit that you talk about over this massive pedal, it's like the end of one of those superb Bach, preludes or organ fugues, where the last 40 bars just build and build and build the tension because the harmony doesn't move. He's doing something very similar. It's an extraordinary passage. And Laura, you mentioned the sort of Beethoven link. There's moments, and this is one of them, where you hear the Missa Solemnis, where you kind of get a blast into a new key, and he sets up a kind of limit and just pushes against it, just as Beethoven does in the Missa Solemnis.
Where do we end up? After all, the first chorus is about blessed are those who comfort, those who mourn. At the end, it's blessed are the dead themselves. I mean, how would you describe the difference between where we start and where we end in the German Requiem? Especially, Brahms makes us ask that question because we're listening pretty well to the same music right at the end of the German Requiem as we start with.
Which goes back to this question of this not being about sort of the apocalypse and redemption. We don't have that kind of narrative through the entire work, but we are asked to go back to almost to the beginning and to contemplate again. You have the harp returning, you have the return of F major. So in a way, this has all been about contemplation rather than necessarily going on a kind of dramatic journey in that sense. So I'm not sure that we've kind of moved further on, but we've certainly thought more deeply about the issues.
Julian.
Yeah, and there is a different texture. He does quote, as you say, the very beginning is quoted at the very end, but the last movement has this sort of sense of flow, the sort of burgeoning life to it, which the calm of the first movement didn't have, kind of carried over from the sixth movement, this fantastic death, where is thy sting? In a grave, where is thy victory? And it's kind of arrived. It sort of fulfills the promise, if you like, of the first movement. It makes me think of a work, of course, that's much, much later in Brahms's output, the Four Serious Songs, where in that wonderful song we have how bitter is death, and then that fantastic change to E major, how sweet is death. And it is that sense, having spent the whole Requiem talking about the comfort for the living, that actually this is, of course, blessed are the dead. So he has put that final twist in, I think, which lifts it somewhere else.
Ladies and gentlemen, questions from the floor.
Thank you. Listening to the discussion about it being a secular or humanist Requiem, I was sort of mindful of that lovely aria, how lovely are thy dwelling places. So certainly, you know, despite everything that's gone before, it seems to express that faith.
And that's the fourth movement, isn't it? So that's the centre of the seven movements. I mean, in a way, the whole work sort of spins around that movement.
One of the things that I hear in this piece over and over again is this sense of, if you like, romantic restlessness. You know, Brahms, Schubert, over and over again you have the figure of the wanderer, the exile, the person who's not at home. So this movement, the one you refer to, how beautiful are your temples, your resting place, that sense of finding a home, and it's the most diatonic, the most peaceful movement. That's definitely played out here, and very interesting to listen, if I may, to some of the other big choral works that Brahms wrote soon after this, straight on the back of this piece, the Song of Destiny, is exactly that, in a really stark contrast between the beautiful, peaceful world, this is a text of Hölderlin, the beautiful, peaceful world of the spirit life in Elysium, versus this hell that is the life on earth, this stormy, stormy hell, which eventually he manages to sort of get out of and recoup where he started. But that's how I hear this fourth movement, as a kind of recompense for some of the stormy music we've heard in the other movements.
Thanks to Julian Johnson and Laura Tunbridge. Thank you all very much indeed.
Tom Service hosting that event on Brahms's German Requiem a little earlier. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Clemency Burton Hill, live on Radio 3, home of the Proms. After a Brahms overture and a Schumann symphony, in the second half we now have a Proms first, Brahms's German Requiem performed on period instruments. Making history tonight, and for the first but not last time this season, is conductor Marin Alsop, along with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, the Choir of the Enlightenment, and soloists Rachel Harnisch and Henk Nevin. Well, as we've heard in tonight's interval, the German Requiem was completed in 1868 when Brahms was 35. But the piece had been taking shape in his mind long before the death of his mother in February 1865 triggered that final compositional push. A North German Protestant by birth, Brahms selected with great care words from the Lutheran Bible rather than the Latin liturgy. However, he avoided all overt Christian references, instead arranging his chosen passages to present, he said, in succession, the ascending ideas of sorrow consoled, doubt overcome, death vanquished. Brahms privately said he could easily have switched the word German for Human in the title, and it's a deeply personal and radiantly moving work whose message seems to be more about consoling the living than offering a vision of the Last Judgment or prayers for the dead. Well, earlier I asked conductor Marin Alsop how a historically informed performance might change how we hear this much-loved work.
I think the main difference is in texture. There's a transparency that one gets with the period instruments that I don't think comes across in, with modern instruments. So in terms of my approach to this piece, it really suits me because it lends itself toward, I think, brisker tempos than we normally encounter with this piece. So the fugues have a lightness to them that they feel to me a little bit too pesante, too bogged down. But when you can't really sustain the sound that long, you have to let things move.
The German Requiem is a vastly different work in character to the Latin liturgical mass of the Catholic tradition. Does it still stand alone?
I think it is unique in the canon because of the way Brahms personalized the piece. And for me, I mean, all I can say is if I had to pick a Requiem for myself, it would undoubtedly be this one because it breaks convention, it defies tradition, and it speaks not to the fear and tumult and, this idea of judging, which so many requiems do, of course, based on the Latin Mass, but instead it speaks about the intimacy of living and being in touch with that joy, and I think that's certainly what I would want to be remembered for.
Marin Alsop talking to me a little earlier there. Well, the work is in seven movements. It begins, "Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted." And it ends, "Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth." A real consolation, this work. And here comes Marin Alsop, along with soloist soprano Rachel Harnish and baritone Henk Nevin. Marin Alsop will conduct the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, the Choir of the Enlightenment too. Here it is, Brahms's German Requiem. The German Requiem of Johannes Brahms. Marin also conducted the first ever period instrument performance of that absolutely magnificent work to take place here at the Proms. The orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment were led tonight by Kati Debrezzini, and the choir of the Enlightenment were led by chorus master Daniel Ludford Thomas. We also heard soloists, the soprano Rachel Harnish and baritone Hank Nevin, both of whom were making their Proms debuts tonight in that extraordinary performance of the German Requiem. Marin Alsop conducting with no score. Also, from here it looked like she was mouthing most of the words in German, which just goes to show her depth of knowledge of both this work and the composer Brahms, who she says has been the most important composer in her life. She described the German Requiem as an affirmation of life. It offers a very holistic, inclusive answer to those existential questions about what happens after this life and where do we go. Well, Brahms, in that sense, continuing the process of democratizing the mysteries of faith that have been set in motion by the likes of Bach, Schütz and Handel, really emphasizing humanity, mortality, grief and resolution rather than a specific deity. Brahms' German Requiem, completely devoid of those terrifying depictions of the Last Judgment or heart-rending pleas for mercy that we're used to in other Requiems, that of Verdi, for example, or even Mozart. Instead, as the philosopher Ernst Bloch put it, a precious depth that avoids apotheoses. A huge cheer going around the Royal Albert Hall for the Choir of the Enlightenment. They're really the stars of this work. Marin Alsop gesturing to the whole orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and she and her soloists taking another bow. What a night here at the Proms. Well, that's it from me, Clemency Burton Hill, and tonight's Prom, live at the Royal Albert Hall, and of course on BBC Radio 3, home of the Proms. Don't forget, you can revisit this Prom and all concerts from the past week via the BBC iPlayer. You can also catch up with our magazine show, Proms Extra, from earlier this evening, when Katie Derham interviewed tonight's conductor, Marin Alsop, who will, of course, be back to make yet more history in just 4 weeks, when she conducts the last night, the first ever woman to do so. And as you can probably hear, the crowd at the Royal Albert Hall going absolutely wild for Marin Alsop tonight. If you've been listening and you've got thoughts about tonight's Prom, you can tweet us at BBC Proms or get in touch via facebook.com/theproms. Well, after that night of history, thank you very much for joining us here on BBC Radio 3. It's time now to head back over to Broadcasting House and my colleague, Jonathan Swain.
Clemency, thank you. Clemency Burton-Hill there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom here on BBC Radio 3 this coming Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, as Clemency was saying, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every Prom's available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website anytime you like for 7 days from the broadcast. Stravinsky's Firebird, Ravel in Spain, and a double trumpet concerto by Matthias Pincher in tomorrow night's live Prom. That's at 7:30. And more on that in just a moment. Looking ahead and later in the week on Thursday night.
At the BBC Proms, the charismatic Italian soprano Anna Caterina Antonacci performs Wagner's Wesendonck-Lieder, a song cycle full of musical references to what would become his opera Tristan and Isolde. It's part of our year of music for Wagner's bicentenary, Wagner 200. Join me, Martin Handley, at the BBC Proms on Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
And that concert also brings performances of two Russian masterworks, Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet And Prokofiev's Fifth Symphony. Yannick Nezet-Séguin conducts the Rotterdam Philharmonic, and that's 7 o'clock, as Martin was saying, on Thursday night. Well, back to this evening, and in just over 20 minutes' time, music from our time in here and now. Tonight, a double bill of Italian music theatre, Salvatore Sciarrino's opera The Killing Flower, based on the true story of Gesualdo's murder of his wife and her lover, and marking 10 years since the death of Luciano Berio, a repeat broadcast of his dramatic work, Passaggio. Here and Now is at 10:15 this evening. Until then, with Stravinsky's The Firebird flying into and working her magic on the Royal Albert Hall in tomorrow night's prom, Stravinsky right now. It's slightly odd to think a decade or so on from the Paris sensations of his The Firebird, Petrushka and The Rite of Spring, Stravinsky was in financial difficulties, but the Russian Revolution had done for his royalties. And to make some money, he chose to brush up his piano technique and perform his own pieces in public. First came the Concerto for Piano and Wind Instruments, and a few years later, in 1929, this Capriccio for Piano and Orchestra. While writing the piece, Stravinsky confessed an enthusiasm for what he called the Beau Brummels of music, Mendelssohn, and in his own words, that prince of music, Carl Maria von Weber. The pianist is Olli Mustonen with the Deutsches Symphonieorchester Berlin, conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazy.
Thank you.
Stravinsky in late 1920s Paris, enjoying himself as only he knew how. His Capriccio. The pianist Olli Mustonen with the Deutsches Symphonieorchester Berlin, conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazy. And Stravinsky's exotic The Firebird is the final music in tomorrow night's live BBC Prom. It opens with Ravel's exploration of Spanish dance forms, Rhapsody Espagnole. And the centrepiece brings two trumpeters, Tina Ting-Helset and Marco Blau, as the virtuoso soloists in the London premiere of Matthias Pinch's double trumpet concerto, Chute d'Etoile. It takes its inspiration from, among other things, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Matthias Pinch himself conducts the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and that's live from the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow night here on BBC Radio 3, starting at 7:30. For the moment, to England some four centuries ago, Orlando Gibbons. The singers there, Stile Antico in Almighty and Everlasting God by Orlando Gibbons.
This year, Radio 3's World Roots Academy has focused on the remarkable and little-known musical culture of Azerbaijan. Join me, Lucy Duran, at the BBC Proms as our Academy protégé, the young singer Fidan Hajiyeva, performs alongside her mentor.
There's me singing around the house on chairs.
On chairs?
Yeah, I would go up on chairs and start singing.
Also on the bill, two groups from Mali, a world debut by a new ensemble of master musicians, Trio Dakali, plus one of the biggest stars on the world music scene, Baseku Kouyaté and Ngoniba. Join us Thursday night at 10 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to the Saturday night. It's just gone 10:15. Time now for Here and Now with Ivan Hewitt.
Hello and welcome to another programme in our series that looks back to the roots of what we now call new music in the avant-garde of the 1950s and 1960s. The focus is prompted partly by the 10th anniversary of the death of that giant figure of post-war music, Luciano Berio. And today we arrive at music by the man himself. Berio had a particular passion for exploring the way musical language and verbal language can be made to interpenetrate and mutually influence each other. And today we'll be hearing a wonderful example of that interpenetration in his piece Passaggio. That's the first half of a double bill. The second half is a work by another Italian composer who explores the way music and language intertwine, Salvatore Sciarrino. The work by Sciarrino is entitled The Killing Flower, and it's inspired by the life of the Renaissance composer Carlo Gesualdo. It comes from a recording made at the Buxton Festival last month. Well, with me to talk about the music we're going to hear is the writer and critic Paul Griffiths, who's been with us on Here and Now for the last two programmes. Paul, welcome. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, Paul, I suppose we should start by saying that this interest in the way music and language meets and mutually influence one another, it's not a peculiarly Italian thing, is it? It was an idea that was around generally in music at that time.
Yes, indeed, but particularly among Italian composers, and particularly, as you say, with Berio, right from the beginning, finding new vocal sounds, new ways of working with voice and instruments and voice and electronics, because he was writing electronic music, or composing, one should say, electronic music in the 50s and 60s, working in new ways with language. Yes, that was always very important to him.
The piece we're going to hear, as I say, is called Passaggio. We're going to hear the piece in a performance conducted by the composer himself, recorded back in 1990 at a series promoted by the BBC called Berio at the Barbican. Now, this is quite a hard thing to grasp on the radio, certainly. I imagine it was quite hard to grasp in the hall itself, because this piece, it doesn't have an obvious narrative, does it, on which one can hang the emotions. It seems to be like a series of, I suppose, what one could call archetypal situations to which the chorus then responds.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It's an opera, we should say. It's the first theatre work that Berio produced, and he went on to produce several more. But like many composers at this time, he was very hesitant about the phenomenon of music in the theatre, because why are people singing? What is the relationship between the pit and the scene and the audience? And he wanted to throw those things open and deal with them in a completely new way, and not tell a story in the way that conventional opera had been, but the actual form of opera was itself to be the story. We were to explore what it meant to have a singer on the stage, what it meant to have a chorus, and to do these things in a new way. This wasn't just a phenomenon of opera, of course. It went along with what was happening in the theatre at the same time, and Passaggio has a lot in common with works by Beckett, for instance, at that time. We have a protagonist. We have one figure on the stage, a female protagonist, who is just called She, who is not so much the controlling figure. We're not. She's not able to express herself very directly to us, so she does try around the edges. She's much more the victim of this opera than the conveyor of it, and she's bombarded by a singing chorus on one side, but also by people in the audience, people who are directed by the score. I mean, this is a kind of audience participation that's actually written in. We have speaking groups in the auditorium who are shouting out, who are demanding things, who are cajoling the protagonist, who are scorning the protagonist. I remember I was at this performance. It's a powerful thing, because you have people sitting right by you who are suddenly jumping up and taking part in the show. And the boundary between the auditorium and the performance area is obliterated.
Yes, and this seems to have caused quite a lot of upset at the first performance, I mean, which seems to have been one of the genuine scandals of 20th century music, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. Modern music concerts in the 50s and early 60s were pretty noisy affairs sometimes, as they were, we've been thinking about it this year in 1913 with the Rite of Spring. But that kind of audience participation that was uncontrolled, that was impromptu, was still going on in the 50s and 60s, and Berio had experienced that, and so was writing it in and saying to the audience, okay, this is the way you want to behave, here you are, I'll write it for you. And the audience was a little bit dumbfounded, I think, at the early performances, as we were still in 1990, when things had become altogether a lot more sedate.
Do you think part of their outrage might have been due to the overtly political nature of the piece?
Yes, well, that's something else with Berio that sort of smouldered in the background. Unlike his great contemporary Luigi Nono, who was, right from the first, a powerfully engaged composer whose music very definitely projected a political message, Berio was always a little bit more uncertain, but also questioning. And that's there in the background of this piece. The protagonist is the victim of political oppression in one aspect of her. She's Rosa Luxemburg in a prison cell. In another aspect of herself, she's a woman in a male-centered society. She's a commodity. She's a victim of advertising. So that all sorts of forces are being represented in this piece. And the oppression that the protagonist is subjected to is kind of mirrored in the vocal writing, that she starts out skidding all over the place, very erratic, virtuoso line, and gradually through the piece, this is not schematic in this way, but this is a sort of basic shape, gradually she is compressed into a sort of middle register, almost speaking voice.
We should warn listeners, I suppose, that the choral part is in many languages, isn't it, Paul?
Including English.
Yes, indeed. So let's hear it now. Passaggio, performed by Luisa Castellani, with students from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama playing the two choruses and members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The performance is conducted by the composer Luciano Berio.
Silenzio! Thank you.